A single car accident victim can require as many as 100 pints of blood. This hour, keeping our blood supply plentiful and safe. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll hear from Dr. Thomas Rafe, director of the DeGowan Blood Center at the University of Iowa. He'll tell us about the many things blood is used for and how screening and testing has improved. Then Mario Machis of Johns Hopkins tells us about his study of how incentives, like T-shirts or gift cards, can dramatically increase blood donors. And finally, how bone marrow donations have changed, and the question of whether giving bone marrow is more like giving blood or more like donating an organ. That's all coming up after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and here's something to be thankful for a couple days before Thanksgiving. The estimated more than 9 million people who give blood each year. And just one astounding relevant statistic, a single car accident victim can require as many as 100 pints of blood. Have you ever donated blood? If you have, what prompted you to do so? And in this season of giving, we want to talk about blood donation. What's the need? How is it processed? How is it safeguarded, our blood supply? And what should you consider when you're considering giving blood? These and other questions we want to discuss with my first guest, Dr. Thomas Rafe, Medical Director at the DeGowan Blood Center at the University of Iowa. Welcome to our studio.
Thank you, Ben.
So tell us in big picture terms, I know nothing about how our blood supply in Iowa and the country works. Explain to me how we keep so much of such a valuable commodity on hand. It's perishable too, isn't it?
Absolutely. And there are different kinds of blood products that we have to consider when we talk about that. Most people think about the red blood cells because that's the common blood product that most people donate. And it has a shelf life of 6 weeks. And so we have to replenish that on a constant basis. And we do that by recruiting donors to donate as often as they're allowed by law, which is every 6 weeks, every 8 weeks, as it turns out. So we can replenish our shelves by getting additional donations from a single donor and by recruiting more donors. And so that product is one that we are constantly shuffling to try to keep on hand.
Generally speaking, are we in pretty good stead as far as the supply that we have, these over 9 million donors? Do they give us what we need, or could we use more and be in better place?
It's actually, overall, we do fairly well in the upper Midwest. The upper Midwest is a very generous place for blood donation compared to other parts of the country. For example, what we do see are occasional times when particular types of blood run short. Many people are familiar with the O negative blood as being the sort of universal donor blood. Because of that, it's a blood that we use more than other types. We use it in little babies, for example, and people whose blood type we haven't had time to figure out yet because of
emergencies. That's always a safe bet.
That's a safe bet. And so for that reason, we go through quite a bit more of it than other kinds of blood. And so there's a demand at many hospitals, especially those that serve trauma victims and little babies and so forth, for that type. So there are times when we run really quite critically short of O negative blood, probably 4 or 5 times per year, something like that.
O negative, the best type for a donor. Is that a rare blood type or in fairly good supply?
15%.
15% of people?
Yes.
Okay. So when someone walks through the door with a blood donation, you find out, or the person on duty finds out, it's O negative,
they get excited.
That's a little bonus.
That's right.
So what is the one a person would get least excited about if I had that blood type?
Well,
in terms of donation.
Yeah, the value in any type of blood depends on what product we're going to take. So I mentioned that red blood cells are one of several products. As it turns out, the plasma part of blood, which is a separate product that's used a lot in trauma resuscitation and certain other settings, surgery settings, is very different from the red blood cells with regard to typing. So actually, O type O blood is not nearly as useful in plasma because it's not compatible with most people. Mm-hmm. And the kind that we like for plasma is type AB, which is only about 3% of donors. And so that one is universally acceptable for any recipient as plasma. But the AB red blood cells are incompatible with anything but AB recipients. So it gets a little complicated.
It does. I can see that. Now, in 2013, what are the biggest challenges that we face in this country, or perhaps you also, to what extent at the DeGowan Blood Center, face in maintaining a safe blood supply? Are there old challenges and emerging challenges? Talk about those.
Yeah, there are. And so the safety of the blood supply is really the paramount concern of all blood collection facilities as well as the federal government. You know, the blood collection industry is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, just like it regulates pharmaceutical industries. And so the attitude among blood collection facilities and the FDA and other regulatory agencies is always to improve the safety of the blood supply. And so today it's far safer than it's ever been in history, certainly much safer than when I began my career 20 years ago by virtue of the testing that we do for various kinds of potentially what we call transmissible diseases, things like hepatitis and AIDS and so forth. So we've really almost conquered those kinds of concerns in the safety of the blood supply. But there are always new kinds of infectious agents that we might be concerned about. Things like West Nile virus, which is a relatively newcomer on the scene of infectious agents within the last decade or so. People right now, we aren't testing for Lyme's disease. That would be something, and related diseases that could emerge to threaten the safety of the blood supply. So between manufacturers of tests and other agencies and ways of screening donors to look for risk factors, there's a constant sort of churning of our methodologies to try to keep the blood safer.
Okay, I come in. I'm an unknown. I want to donate blood, but I'm unknown. What happens? What is the first step in that screening process? You get my name and my details in that way, but then you ask me some questions.
That's right. And those questions and the things that we do in screening donors are really based on two considerations. One, the safety of the donor themselves. So one of the first things that we will do is what we call a mini physical examination, which amounts to testing your blood pressure, your pulse, and looking at your blood count to make sure that you have an adequate blood count and that your vital signs, as we call them, are normal so that you'll be able to tolerate that loss of blood volume safely. The other half of it or so is our concerns about recipients. We call them recipient safety considerations. So those would be things like, do you have a history of hepatitis? Have you had a tattoo or piercing, other things that can potentially expose you to an infectious disease that might potentially, you know, threaten the safety of the unit that you would donate? And so there are something like, I'm going to say, almost 50 questions in this questionnaire now that address all kinds of concerns like that.
Here's one that always catches me because I have tried multiple times, a few times, to try to donate. And because I lived in Europe in the 1990s, I am eliminated from being a possible donor because it was the period of mad cow disease.
That's exactly right. So that was one of the, I would say, a half a dozen or so new potential infectious organisms that the world of blood banking became concerned about in the late 1990s. And so during that crisis, as it were, in Europe, when mad cow disease became epidemic in many places in Europe, one of the first questions that was asked was, well, is this a disease that is transmissible from one human being to another? It was very clear that it was possible to contract that disease as a human by eating a contaminated animal. Mm-hmm. But whether or not that human now infected with that so-called prion disease or mad cow disease was capable of transmitting that to another human being via blood was really not known. And so part of what the blood collection establishment, the FDA, and blood collection facilities have to do when they're faced with these kinds of epidemics is make decisions without having enough knowledge to really understand that. And they have to decide whether we need to do something based on a consideration of potential risk. And that's what happened in that particular case. So the Food and Drug Administration decided there was a potential risk. And so we had to change the way we collect blood as a result.
In my instance, for instance, will that ever be lifted? Or we just it's an unknown, so we don't want to take that risk.
That's exactly right. And so almost always, if there is a clear history of a potential exposure to something that could be a transmissible agent, that becomes a permanent deferral. Now, not all people who visit Europe are deferred from donating because that epidemic came and it went. So people who live there today would not necessarily be deferred.
Dr. Rafe, you said that infectious diseases have been really a lot of progress has been made over the last few decades since you began in this career, for instance, in identifying them, screening them out of the process, making sure they don't get into our blood supply.
That's correct.
What are some emerging problems that you're seeing now that are trickier to deal with?
Well, the biggest concern that blood collection facilities have is this sort of unknown virus that might emerge suddenly on the horizon. A good example of a recent one was SARS. You might recall that there was an epidemic of SARS among travelers and that there was quite a big campaign to contain that particular virus by the CDC and other organizations. Well, we were very much concerned about the blood supply as well. So as soon as those kinds of emerging viruses make themselves known in this country, then blood collection facilities typically will go into action very quickly to screen donors for potential exposure and to eliminate those where there is a suspicion that might be the case. And so those kinds of infectious agents, be they viral like SARS was or bacterial or parasitic, are sort of a constant threat to the blood supply. One of the newest tests that we have is for a disease called Chagas disease that most people in the United States haven't heard of, but it's endemic in Central and South America. It's known to be transmitted in blood. And so a test has been developed for it, and now we're employing that test as a part of our blood screening safety, even though it's a disease most people have never heard of and is really not very commonly transmitted in the United States. And so I would say that it's hard to predict what will be the next big infectious agent that will make it on the list of something that we have to screen carefully for or test for.
Is there an equivalent to a weather alert system, a blood alert system that everybody's red flags go up across the country in your business?
Exactly. That's how that works. The Food and Drug Administration has the ultimate jurisdiction over this, and so if they become concerned about something, they issue bulletins that alert blood collection facilities that they need to modify their processes to minimize the risk. We also have volunteer organizations. The organization that many centers, including the Gallen, belongs to used to be called it's called AABB, or America's Blood Centers. And that organization has a great network of dispensing information about potentially emerging infectious agents, both on a regional as well as a national level. So, you know, in an event like several years ago in Iowa City, there was an outbreak of mumps, as many people who have lived here a while.
That, yes.
And so the University of Iowa campus was kind of the epicenter of a big outbreak, and in eastern Iowa, several college campuses. So, you know, that's an infectious agent whose transmissibility in blood isn't really known well because there haven't been outbreaks for so very long that it's really unclear whether that's transmissible or not. But in that case, we employ the same sort of safety concerns that we do about other things that we don't understand completely. So blood centers in central and eastern Iowa employed a number of temporary measures to screen donors for their potential exposure to that mumps epidemic. And then when the epidemic went away, then we lifted those measures.
If you've just joined us, Dr. Thomas Rafe is my guest, medical director at the DeGowan Blood Center at the University of Iowa. We're talking in this season of giving about donating blood, the millions of people who do that across the country, millions of people across the country, and many Iowans who do that on a regular basis, sort of a look at the anatomy of blood donation with Dr. Rafe this hour. Tell us a little bit about the DeGowan Blood Center, because there are, you know, we see them in advertisements, we see them all different types of blood centers out there. How is yours different? How does it fit into the bigger picture of all the places that collect blood?
The DeGowan Blood Center is a little different than most places in the upper Midwest because we're a hospital-based program. And so the industry of blood collection is fundamentally a network of regional and local blood centers. There's a large blood center in Des Moines called LifeServe. The Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center in Davenport serves, and those places serve multiple, up to hundreds of hospitals by collecting blood and testing it and distributing it to the hospitals. DeGowan, on the other hand, we supply blood only to University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, and so we're a bit more of a boutique operation in that regard. We have some specialty products that most blood centers don't collect. For example, we have a product called granulocytes, which is a white blood cell product that we only make for special patients who are extremely ill and have very low blood counts, usually due to chemotherapy or some other reason like that. And so we stimulate donors actually with a medication that causes them to make a lot of these white blood cells, and then we collect them for those donors. So that's an unusual service that we do. We only do it for patients in our hospital. We have a very active donor base for a variety of products. We collect a lot of our products by automated collection, as we call it, or apheresis. These are instruments that are centrifuge-based, and the blood comes out just a little bit at a time from the patient's arm and into these instruments, and it's centrifuged and separated, and the instrument will actually make a red blood cell product, for example, a plasma product, a platelet product.
Break it down into its components.
Into its components and all in one setting. It can make several different products all in one sitting of the donor, an hour and a half or so donation, something like that.
It sounds to me a lot like we're talking about, you know, we always talk about how oil can be made into so many products.
Yes.
Oil. And it sounds in some ways very similar. That, like oil, you can make plastics or you can make all kinds of things we wouldn't normally associate with oil. And the blood, how many components can blood be broken up into and used as products?
It's almost limitless, actually. Now, the fundamental products that we make typically are the red blood cells and then the plasma and then the platelets and occasionally, as I mentioned, another cellular product like white blood cells or granulocytes. But the plasma component of blood is enormously complicated. It probably has at least 10,000 different components to it. And that alone can be made into innumerable different products. Historically, we make antihemophilic factor. We make immune globulins out of plasma. We make albumin out of plasma. There are many, many other purified proteins that can only be collected from plasma because the synthetic approaches haven't been developed yet. So there are companies that are in business that make lots of different products out of that part of blood.
Does the DeGowan Center ever need to purchase blood from other nonprofit centers?
We do. Mm-hmm. We supplement our supply, particularly of red blood cells. We're able to collect a little less than half of what we use at university hospitals. And the rest of it we purchase from our secondary suppliers.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the people who donate. What can you tell me? You must be very interested in the profile of donors, blood donors, people who come several times a year to donate blood. Tell us about a typical donor and what motivates them.
Yeah, they do. And you know, we have donors of their motivations are always, of course, very important to us. We have people who are young people in high school who donate for the first time and then become, you know, regular donors because it's a rewarding experience from them. There are people who have donated hundreds and hundreds of products over decades to DeGallen Blood Center. These are the people who, you know, you just cannot imagine what better community service they could possibly provide than to come back again and again and donate products for patients at our hospital.
In this profile of blood donors, you must also be interested in the question of common reasons people have for not donating blood. When people are concerned about it, what do you find they're most concerned with?
Well, I think the idea that we get blood with a needle is always a consideration.
There you go. Yeah, that's an easy one.
Right. And I think that people are concerned not so much necessarily that that will be a particularly unpleasant experience, which it's not, but rather they're kind of afraid of being afraid. You know, perhaps they're afraid that they might have some kind of a reaction that might be embarrassing to them. And so there's just a little bit of reluctance in there, and sometimes that's all it takes to just walk past the entrance to the blood center or past the blood drive and not participate. But there I can tell you that in the industry there have been enormous efforts put into trying to understand the sort of the thinking and the psychology and so forth that goes into what motivates people to donate and what are those barriers to donation, always trying to improve on that.
Mm-hmm. I understand one of the challenges in your area currently is something called trolley. What is that?
Transfusion-related acute lung injury. So it's one of those esoteric sort of words that we use in our industry. And the reason it's become more common to speak of, at least in medical circles, and medical students are starting to recognize this term and that sort of thing, is because as the risk from receiving blood products of infectious disease transmission that we talked about earlier has really receded with all of the very sophisticated testing and screening that we do nowadays, other causes of, or other adverse effects associated with transfusion have kind of risen to take their place. And as it turned out, this very sort of severe and sudden onset of acute lung injury called trolley is the most commonly reported cause of death from transfusion in the United States today, which is something I'm sure most people don't know. But statistically, that's where the blood industry is now. And so, like other things, the blood industry then takes very seriously those kinds of threats. And so we go to quite a bit of trouble to try to prevent that particular complication.
Being in the blood business, Dr. Rafe, I have to ask you, I imagine you must run into an untold number of misconceptions about blood. We live in an era where vampires are very, very popular. Zombies are very popular. Do you run into misconceptions about blood that are fueled by popular culture, movies, and so forth?
Actually, there are many, many misconceptions about blood in terms of its safety by the public, because it takes a long time for knowledge really to be disseminated. And so the safety of the blood supply is something that I think, in my experience with patients, they're very much worried about concerns that really the blood industry pretty well conquered. You can never say it's entirely safe, of course, but pretty well conquered a decade ago.
Okay, Dr. Rafe, and lastly, are blood donations turn out to be, I mean, we said this is a season of giving. Does it turn out that giving blood is also seasonal?
It is, very much. And you know, we try to make it that way because we have holidays ourselves, and our donor center isn't open every single day on holidays, and so we need to kind of stockpile, so we try to play up that this is a good time to give, and we try to get our calendar full of donations.
Okay. Dr. Rafe, how do people find out more?
You can look at the website for DeGallen Blood Center, which is on the UIHC website, and you can call our blood center anytime.
Okay. Dr. Thomas Rafe, Medical Director of the DeGallen Blood Center at the University of Iowa. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment after a short break, we'll talk with blood donor Brett Larson of Des Moines, who has a very special reason for giving regularly. Also, Mario Matches of Johns Hopkins Business School tells us about his study of how incentives, like T-shirts or gift cards, can dramatically increase blood donors. And finally, improvements in bone marrow donations. That's when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, Politics Wednesday, I'll be away, but Ben Stanton, my colleague, will be in the host chair to talk about, among other things, that agreement between global powers, including the U.S. and Iran, over Iran's nuclear capability, and also the nuclear option, the so-called nuclear option, employed by the Senate Democrats, stripping the ability to block President Obama's judicial and executive branch nominees with the filibuster, redoing the filibuster rule. Two of the big topics tomorrow on Politics Day. Today we're talking about how we keep our blood supply plentiful and safe, how to donate blood, what's involved in the spirit of this season of giving and thanks. In just a moment, we'll talk with Mario Machis of Johns Hopkins Business School. He'll tell us about his study on how incentives like, oh, I don't know, T-shirts or gift cards can dramatically increase the number of blood donors. Also, how blood bone marrow donations have changed. What comes to mind when I say the word bone marrow donation, right? Big, long needle, not so much anymore. We'll hear about that in just a few minutes. Okay, remember I said at the beginning of the program, over 9 million blood donors annually in this country. Let's talk to just one of them, just one. One named Brett Larson in Des Moines. Hi, Brett.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. Just staying warm.
Okay, that's important on this kind of day. The sun's, though, has come out. But, Brett, you have given blood how long? When was the first time you gave blood?
I gave blood back. The first time would have been in high school when I went to Roosevelt here in Des Moines. It was at a clinic that they sponsored at our high school, and I gave it the first time there and just kind of actually did it a couple more times and then fell off just due to a myriad of other reasons.
Do you remember initially what your motivation was?
You know, wanting to help others. My grandparents had both had cancer, and I remember them receiving blood donations, and so I decided that when the opportunity presented itself that I'd go ahead and give it a shot.
Mm-hmm. Then you had a life event that changed your attitude, I believe. What was this, college age?
Yeah, it was right after college, actually. It was about 2 years after graduating from Drake, also here in Des Moines, where I was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma, a form of bone cancer. And I hadn't donated for a while, but I soon realized just how valuable and important that was to have blood donors.
Mm-hmm. So you went through chemotherapy? How many rounds?
I went through 14 rounds of chemotherapy, including a surgery in the middle.
Mm-hmm. So when you're going through chemotherapy, why are you needing blood?
Well, as you go through chemo, it takes a pretty heavy toll on your bone marrow, which will ultimately affect your blood counts, red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. Mm-hmm. And I made it through the first two rounds without receiving any blood. But after that, I tanked so low that they said that I needed to start receiving blood. And then towards the end, my platelets were so low that I had to also start receiving platelets along with the red blood cells.
Mm-hmm. So you became a recipient of blood components here. How did that change your view of, you know, what we hear ubiquitously and have for generations in our society, that the blood donation's a good thing? Did it change your view? How?
It did very much so. I knew for a long time that it was a good thing because I had seen it firsthand through family members, including my father, who had also had cancer. And it never quite hits home until you have to receive it yourself. And so finally realizing just how much blood I needed and then platelets on top of that and how many donors that would have taken to fulfill that need just for me, and then seeing all the other cancer patients who are receiving it, and then, of course, you know, trauma patients and other diseases, mm-hmm. All these people needing blood on a regular basis definitely shifted my perception to a first-person one, I guess.
Yeah. How many years ago since you went through the chemotherapy and the cancer treatment?
It was 5 years ago. October 31st is when I finished.
Mm-hmm. Any sign of cancer anymore?
No, sir, not at all.
Congratulations, Brett Larson.
Thank you.
And tell me, you're a regular blood donor now?
Yes, sir. A positive, but I guess they have enough of that for now, so I give them platelets as often as I can, about once a month.
Okay. Brett Larson, do you happen to recruit others and say, hey, this blood donation thing is very important? Have you given blood lately?
Yep, I try to go out of my way to get people to, if they can, to go out. I definitely talk about it and try to get people to go in, because it is a real need for young and old and all different backgrounds.
Okay, Brett Larson, thanks for sharing your story with us.
You betcha. Thank you, sir.
And let's turn now to Mario Machis. He's an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins University Carey Business School. Professor Machis, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your program, and I very much enjoyed your conversation with Dr. Rafe earlier and the experience of your donor listener. So thanks.
Oh well, thank you for listening. Thank you for the comment. Now you've done a specific study that looked at the effects of incentives on raising, increasing blood donations, the number of donors. What exactly did you look at?
Well, actually, Ben, together with my co-authors, Nicola Cetera, the University of Toronto, and Bob Slonim, the University of Sydney, we have conducted a number of studies in partnership with blood banks in the U.S., in Italy, in Argentina. And the common theme of these studies has been, the question whether incentives, economic incentives in particular, can help increase blood donations.
Mm-hmm.
So the study in the U.S., the studies that we've conducted in the U.S. were done in partnership with the American Red Cross in Northern Ohio, for example. In the first study, we analyzed the effect of a variety of incentive items that the Red Cross in Northern Ohio offers to their donors, ranging from T-shirts to coupons, coolers, umbrellas, hats, blankets, you name it. And the remarkable finding from this study, at least from our point of view, was that the effect of each and every single item was positive. So meaning that the offer of these incentive items increased donations.
Even if it's something like a T-shirt that you go out, it will prompt people to go out the door, get off work a little early, or do something to make a blood donation.
Even a T-shirt. And in fact, the point estimate that we have for the effect of offering a T-shirt was pretty substantial. T-shirt offer increases donations by 20%. Now, another remarkable finding that we have is that the effect of these incentive items on donations increases with the monetary value of the incentives. For example, a sweater increases donations by 38%, according to our results. A jacket by 70%, which is a remarkable result.
How is this different than just giving money, paying people for their blood?
Oh, that's a great question. There are many differences that we have seen and documented. Actually, one frustrating aspect of the debate of, whether incentives, economic incentives, should be used to compensate or to reward blood donors is that the debate is typically framed as if there are only two extremes, either no compensation whatsoever on the one hand, or cash payments on the other. In fact, there are a variety of solutions in between these two extremes. And the specific solution that the American Red Cross in Ohio has adopted is one example. Incentives are not presented as payments. They are presented as rewards, which donors can interpret as, rewards or tokens of appreciation for a good deed, for a good act. When presented in this way, incentives can generate extra donations without conflicting with the donor's, intrinsic motivation to do well.
Mm. And I understand that this is important because, for instance, the World Health Organization, several other national blood collection agencies have for decades been of the view that offering economic incentives to blood donors is detrimental. In what ways?
That's right. So there are three main oppositions to the provision of incentives to blood donors. So the first is that providing incentives might conflict with the donor's intrinsic motivation, and therefore it might create a psychological effect by which the donations might actually go down as a consequence of an extrinsic or explicit reward being introduced. to reward an act that people perform in the absence of rewards. The second concern is a concern about safety, that incentives, in particular cash payments, could attract the wrong kind of donor, donors who are motivated by the money, who might have higher probability of presenting some risk factors, such as, you know, propensity of carrying some transmissible disease, of making use of drugs, etc. And there's also an ethical concern about the commodification of body parts. Mm-hmm. Those are three concerns. In our studies, in particular in the study in the United States, we found positive effects of incentives on all subsets of donors that we could look at, including donors who have been donors for a long time, donors who are frequent donors, and donors with a long history of donation. You might think they have a strong intrinsic motivation to give blood, and yet even those donors have shown have been stimulated by incentives. The second concern, the concern of about safety. In our study with the American Red Cross, we had one proxy for blood safety, which was the fraction, the proportion of donors who present to donate with the intention to donate at the blood drives, but are discarded or deferred for a number of reasons, including sex behavior, risky sexual activities, travel to certain regions of the world, etc. Well, we found that when incentives were offered, there was no effect on the share of donors who were not eligible to donate, okay, our proxy for quality or safety of donors.
So that's good news. That's a good takeaway here. But what happens if community A and community B are next to each other, and community A has incentives and community B doesn't? So you can siphon away, so to speak, donors from the neighboring community?
That is a great question. We actually have designed the second study that we conducted with the American Red Cross in Ohio was a randomized controlled trial. Among the many great things about our study, if I can say so myself, is that we were able to observe not just the effect of incentives at the locations where and when they were offered. We were also able to look at whether the provision of incentives here and now affect donations at neighboring drives. And we did find what we call in our paper substitution effects or displacement effects. A fraction of the extra donations that were generated by the incentives, caused by the incentives, were actually donations that would have occurred, would have been made anyway in neighboring locations. So there was a little bit of donor stealing by those by the incentives. Now, blood banks are very interested, and the Red Cross was very interested in learning about this phenomenon, because clearly this has implications for how the allocation of incentives is designed. This is it's not a desirable thing, like to steal donors from one drive to another. It's costly, first of all. It doesn't increase total donations necessarily. Now, this was just the displacement effect was a fraction of the total effect. Mm-hmm. The net effect of incentives was still positive and sizable, fortunately.
Mario Machis is with us, assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins University Carey Business School, talking about some new findings about how to incentivize people to donate blood. And I want to talk with you because I want to introduce another guest in just a moment, Mario. Let's talk about bone marrow, because there's been some developments there too. Bone marrow is needed in certain medical cases. But the question has come up, is bone marrow more like a blood donation or an organ donation? Tell us, what have you looked at?
Well, in December of 2011, the Ninth District Circuit Court ruled that because of the similarities between bone marrow donations through the apheresis method to plasma donations or blood donations, then it's permissible to compensate bone marrow donors. Now, I'm not a medical doctor, but from the point of view of a prospective donor, I see some similarities. in that just like giving blood or plasma, in the case of a bone marrow donation, an individual is giving some material which is regenerated relatively quickly by the body, and whose donation requires entails a minimal risk. So, given this similarity, this similarity has been made possible by this new technique to extract stem cells from the bloodstream, as opposed to using the needle to extract bone marrow.
Mario Matches, please stay with us. We have a medical doctor with us. He's the medical director for the Gift of Life Bone Marrow Registry, based in Boca Raton, Florida. Dr. Bruce Lennis, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening here. Now we want to get the medical view of this here, too. First, we talked about the change there in how bone marrow is collected. But first of all, give us your take on the question of whether bone marrow donors should be compensated. Is it more like giving blood, or is it more like donating an organ?
Yeah, I think that the real question is from the perspective of the patient. And that has to be, is there always an adequate amount of the product that's needed, be it blood or bone marrow, to meet the needs of the patients? And right now in the United States, if you are Caucasian and you need a bone marrow, you can find a compatible match at around 80 to 85% of the time. It's significantly less for minorities, blacks and Hispanics, and island, Native Americans, et cetera, because they don't have as many people in the pool. We have instituted mechanisms to go ahead and try to increase the minority populations. Whether incentives are necessary or not, that's debatable. And whether they affect the safety, it's debatable. Right now in the United States, the norm, 98, 99% of the time, the donations of both blood and bone marrow are given altruistically. And that is without people being rewarded, except for the small incentives that we use to recognize people's donations.
Mm-hmm. And how is now a bone marrow donation different from making a blood donation? I tried this out on several colleagues because I thought perhaps this is just something that I have stuck in my head. But when I, on a non-medical, growing up just in the United States, I hear bone marrow donation, and I saw a big long needle in front of me. I must have heard that many times growing up. That's not really the way most of it is done now, is it?
That's correct. In the last decade or so, we've moved more towards the use of apheresis, which is where we put a needle in one arm and a needle in the other arm. We give the donor a special medication, which makes the stem cells that are in the donor's bone marrow less sticky so that they start to float around in their peripheral bloodstream. We then use this apheresis machine to take the whole blood out of the one arm, centrifuge it, separate it, and put it into a bag, combine all of the other cells that were taken out and the liquid and put it back into the donor's other arm, so that we're able to get, by the use of this magic medicine, we're able to get enough stem cells to do a bone marrow transplant.
Mm-hmm. How long has this newer technique, apheresis, been around?
Oh, it's been around for decades. We've used it for bone marrow donations for about the last 10 years or so. And all of the studies show that it's very safe and very efficacious, and it's a good way to go. So that right now in the United States, about 70% of bone marrow collections are done through that process.
I have to believe, Dr. Lennis, that's made a big difference in terms of people's willingness to donate bone marrow.
You know, bone marrow is a very special thing. It's very one-on-one. It's one of the very few things that a person can do in their lifetime to directly save the life of another human being. You go ahead and literally you have the person's entire mature blood cell system being given from one person into another so that that second person can live and have a normal, healthy life. It's one of the most incredible altruistic things that someone can do. Bone marrow is riskier than donating whole blood. because the donor has to take this medication, so that the qualifications, the informed consent process that they go through, and the screening that we do is very, very extensive, and it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Much more expensive than just blood.
How are we to think about bone marrow? Bone marrow is sort of the factory of blood, right, in our bones.
Yeah. Our bone marrow contains all of the precursors of all of the mature cells that we have in our bloodstream, so that the red cells, the platelets, and the different kinds of white cells are all produced from cells that originate in the bone marrow.
Okay. Not much time yet left, Dr. Lennis, but please tell us, for those interested, there are registries out there for bone marrow, and these are important to be on if you're interested in being a donor. How do you go about that?
Absolutely. The Gift of Life, the bone marrow registry that I work for, will go ahead and actually send out a kit, and you can take a swab, and it doesn't require anything more than putting the swab inside your mouth and rubbing your cheek. Some of those cells rub off from your mouth and get put into a little vial that gets sent back, and the testing can be performed. The National Marrow Donor Program, Be the Match, also has that same capacity.
Okay, quickly, on the web, how do we find that information?
www.giftoflife.org.
Okay.
www.giftoflife.org.
Dr. Bruce Lennis, thank you for joining us from Florida.
Thank you.
And thank you again, Mario Machis of the Johns Hopkins University Carey Business School. Thank you for sharing your studies with us.
Thank you.
River to River, produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Also help from Dennis Reese. The executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Tomorrow, tune in for Politics Day. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.